Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 165 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe, that's Crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Remember that if there are any long-distance charges, you will be responsible for them. I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand, using my own photographs. To sweeten the deal, I have a pile of books here that I'm willing to give to the first person who writes specifically asking for one of these books and providing a nice review of what's good about the show or maybe what's not good about the show. That's all you need to do. I'll even pay the postage. Miller's Review of Critical Vaccine Studies by Neil Z. or Z. Miller. He was interviewed on the show. Science is Not What You Think by Henry Bauer, also interviewed. Crash Override by Zoe Quinn. Her book was reviewed on the last episode. Plague by Kent Heckenlively and Judy Mikovits. Judy was interviewed on the show. The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism, James Lyons Weiler, also interviewed on the show. And finally, The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World by Allison Wolfe, also interviewed. So just write to me, make sure you include your mailing address, tell me which book you'd like, and include a nice little statement about the show, good or bad. Of course, I'd prefer good, but if you think it's bad, then tell me. If you would like to sponsor the show as an individual or an advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, or you can make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my show, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and recommending this show to your friends. And here's a little bit of feedback. Don wrote, "Hi, David. Great show. I felt that Lindsay Shepherd was unfairly criticized by the university. Then their attack on Jordan Peterson maybe gave them some justification. I'd never heard of this guy, so after investigating him, I even felt more upset. This guy is an academic and not an alt-right extremist. My opinion, this college is against free speech. If you see a different side of Jordan Peterson, please let me know." So I want to respond on the air. I'm not a Jordan Peterson fan. I think he has good qualities, and I'm glad he's broached a debate, but he's done it in a very divisive way. Instead of trying to find a middle ground on genderless pronouns, he just refused to use them. He's pulling people apart, not together. He also, as I mentioned, was planning to start a website to discourage people from taking courses in subjects he doesn't like. Anything that could be tarred as feminism, gender studies, Marxism, etc. It's fine for him to disagree with these people, but he wanted to set up a website that would have encouraged harassment and could have even led to physical violence. Luckily, he dropped the idea, but it was hardly helpful. We need people like him in the discussion, but if everyone goes to the corner of the room, we'll never have a meeting in the middle. And I think his $50,000 a month Patreon campaign is making things worse, because the more strident his comments are, the more money he gets. Now his professor's salary is largely irrelevant. It's needed only to keep his job, to maintain his gravitas as a professor at the University of Toronto. Sherry wrote, "I listened to some more of your podcasts over the weekend. I like your interviewing style. You are patient and let people talk, even when you disagree with some aspects of a subject. It makes a much better conversation for the listener to follow along with. Unfortunately, it's not something you hear very much of anymore, with people yelling and talking over each other to make their point. Have a great week, and I will be listening. Thanks, Sherry. I appreciate your comment. And I'd certainly like more comments, if that's at all possible. And you, yes, I'm talking to you, could participate by sending me an email, sending a message on the Facebook page, through Twitter, whatever you feel is the best way to do it. We talked about grammar last week in the context of gender-neutral pronouns. Well, France is having its own war about the politics of grammar, but in this case, it's still back to the whole male-female thing. Everything in French, Spanish, Italian, and similar Romance languages has a gender. So in Spanish, a table is feminine, la mesa, plural, las mesas. But in Italian, it's masculine, il tavolo, i tavoli in the plural. In French, again, it's feminine, un table, although there's no difference in sound as far as I can take between un and un. French likes to add vowels and suffixes to words that either have no sound or have the same sound as a completely different spelling, unlike Spanish and Italian that are largely phonetic languages. Anyway, clearly these words are grammatically feminine, not really feminine. A table is neither masculine nor feminine. Even animals may have a single gender, even if it doesn't correspond with their actual gender. In Spanish and French, for example, monkeys are always masculine, even if they're a female monkey, which is the opposite of tables. But in Italian, monkeys are always feminine, which is the opposite of tables. In Italian, the tree is usually masculine, such as melo for an apple tree, but the fruit is feminine, mela. This becomes even more political with job titles that are usually modified for women, or traditionally were modified for women, in a way that trivializes the position. In French, a mère is la mère, but a female mère is la mairesse. Montreal now has its first female mayor, and Quebec, being more progressive in this area, she is la mère. So they use the feminine la with the male job title. But in Paris, when the woman mayor asked for the same thing, there was outrage by the conservative language establishment and even a government edict to not use inclusive language in government communications. So 314 French teachers recently signed a declaration that they would not teach old sexist rules about grammar, such as the French rule that if you have a group of one man and 99 women, the collective is supposed to be masculine. Some have proposed that a group take on the gender of the majority. Alternatively, some languages have a neuter gender or don't use gender much at all, such as English. Although I should say we're not perfect, we did have feminine job titles that are slowly going out of fashion, such as stewardesses and actresses, which are now generally called flight attendants and actors, regardless of whether it's a man or a woman. And then there was the fight over Miss and Mrs. versus Ms. that I described last time. The Chinese may have it right. Gender is a foreign concept in that language. There are words to describe men and women, for example, nanren and nuren, but in general, there is no gender. For example, ta refers to he, she, or it, and job titles generally the same, although there may be exceptions. I'm not an expert on the language. The New York Times and the Globe and Mail had articles on this. The New York Times article in particular, which I'll link to from the show notes, also links to an article in French if you can read French or if you want to translate it through Google or some other translator. Who knew that grammar could be so political? And now let's go to this week's interview. And because it's fairly short, afterwards I'll have a little bit of commentary. Justin Trottier is an English-Canadian writer, nonprofit executive director, and former political candidate. He was one of several founding members of secular organizations such as the Centre for Inquiry Canada in 2007, where he served as national executive director until 2011. He also founded the Free Thought Association of Canada, which created the 2009 Atheist Bust campaign, where Trottier served as one of the spokesmen. He also founded the Canadian Secular Alliance. In 2011, he was a Green Party candidate in the Ontario provincial election. Later, Trottier co-founded and has served as the chairman and spokesperson for the Canadian Association for Equality, Nona's Cafe, and was heavily involved in their campaign to open the Canadian Center for Men and Families in 2014. He's currently the center's director. Welcome to the show, Justin.
Thank you for having me on.
Yes, so can you describe the purpose of CAFE, the Canadian Association for Equality?
We are a registered educational charity, and our mandate is to integrate the perspectives and the issues relating to boys, men, and fathers in gender equality. So we look at what are the men's health issues that are largely underexplored or unexplored, and how can we bring more resources to understand men's health issues and then to start to address some of the gaps with respect to those particular issues.
Right. Whenever so-called men's rights groups are mentioned in the media, they're portrayed as a bunch of women-hating misogynists who want to blame women for all their problems, such as lack of success at school, failure of their marriage, loss of custody of their children. So how do you respond to that characterization of what you're doing, for example?
Well, you've just described some people's understanding of men's rights groups.
Mm-hmm.
We're not a men's rights group. As I said, we run a men's health organization. So we provide mental health programs for men. We run counseling. We do peer support groups. We have social workers and psychotherapists that provide pro bono mental health programs at the Center for Men and Families, which we operate. We also run a fathering after separation program, which is focused on supporting dads in the context of a family breakup so that they can be better fathers for their kids. I can't imagine how anybody could have any issues with health programs. Some people might, but I'm not really aware of what the reason for that would be. But I can tell you we work very collaboratively with hospitals, with victim service organizations, with police. We get referrals actually from many hospitals and many mental health agencies across Toronto and beyond.
So what are some of the health issues that are worse for men than for women?
Well, I'm not sure if they're worse for men than for women, but what we're trying to do is to close the gap in terms of services for men. So the difference is that there are far fewer services for men than for women. So I'm not interested in sort of competing over who has it worse. We'll have to have somebody else on the show for that debate.
Okay.
But I am interested in making sure that everybody has the support that they need. And the reality is that there are far fewer services available for boys and men. The Fathering After Separation program, for example, there's nothing like that in Toronto. There are a number of programs for single mothers, probably not enough. I'd like to see more of those. But there's essentially no programs or almost no programs for single fathers. So we're trying to close the gap. And certainly in the context of a family breakup, this is a really stressful situation for everybody involved in a divorce or a separation. We think it's important to empower and to provide healthy ways for men to get the support that they need when they're in that kind of stressful situation so that they can be better fathers for their children. It's as simple as that.
Right. I mean, but isn't it true that men have especially young men, have a higher suicide rate than women, for example?
That's what the statistics tell us, yes.
Yeah.
The suicide rates for men at all ages, but in particular the younger ages, are 3 to 4 times the rates for women. And I think this, again, this speaks to a lack of support, a lack of maybe safe places, in fact, where men can go, where they can open up about the issues that are impacting them and then get positive healing so that they can deal with them in a healthy way and so that they don't act out or deal with them in a way that harms themselves or others, but instead they choose healthy approaches to getting through those challenges in their life.
Right. And your current project is to open a center for abused men, which probably surprises a lot of people who feel that domestic abuse is mostly a man against woman issue. But what is the situation with men experiencing domestic violence?
Yeah, it's not that different from any other population who's experiencing domestic violence. And again, our belief is everybody should have the support that they need. So right now there is zero shelters for male abuse victims. And if you are a father who is dealing with abuse that you're suffering and where your children may actually be also at risk or actually being endangered, then you have precisely no options. And in fact, it's actually worse than no options, because if you do reach out, let's say to the police, you're very likely to find yourself looked at as the aggressor, as the perpetrator of the violence. We have many, many examples of men who have called the police, and even though they've got bruises, they're bleeding, they've got witnesses even, the police immediately enter that scene, presupposing that it's the man who is the aggressor and the woman who's the victim, and very likely he will then be removed from his house.
Oops, a bit of a technical problem. Justin?
Yep.
Okay, so let's start it. Again. You were just saying that when the police arrive, they usually assume that the woman's the aggressor.
Right, so they assume this sort of gender binary way of looking at domestic abuse before they've even entered a scene, before they've collected evidence or spoken to witnesses. They already know that the man is the aggressor and the woman is the victim, and then they proceed accordingly, which generally means that they would remove the man from the house, they would arrest him, they would charge him with assault, put him in jail. And remember, they may be very well leaving behind children, children who are now left with the actual abusive party who, and now have nobody to defend them or to get them out of an abusive situation. So it's a horrible situation. And for fathers in that situation, it's a catch-22, because either you call the police or you leave so that you're out of the way of this abuse. But then when you do that, you're leaving your children behind. And yet there's no shelters where a father can take his children to get the whole family to safety. A lot of dads will stay and subject themselves to abuse in order to at least have some ability to support their children. Never mind the fact that if, you know, one thing leads to another, the family breaks up and there's a separation or divorce, the family courts are not very often father-friendly. Again, it's a very good chance that his relationship with his children will never be the same again if the situation does deteriorate to that extent. So there's a whole bunch of intersecting issues that make it very, very challenging for a dad in an abusive situation.
Right. I mean, I was going to say that, you know, physically, men are usually bigger. The average man is bigger than the average woman. So how can violence be an issue when, you know, a man could just resist? Is it generally the fact that there's children involved that causes
this situation? Even if there
isn't
children involved, that's a real stereotyping of domestic abuse. Mm-hmm. It's not at all consistent with the facts. Women will make up for that size differential in all sorts of ways. They will use weapons. They will throw things. They will throw boiling water. They will use knives. I've heard all of this. A man will be asleep, and he'll be attacked in his sleep when he can't defend himself. And also, I mean, most men are peaceful people, just as most women are, by the way. So if a woman is assaulting a man, he's not just going to hit her back. We've trained men not to hit women. We haven't trained women not to hit men in the same way. So, no, I mean, the facts just bear out what I'm telling you, that women can be aggressive to men. They're able to make up for that size differential in all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. There's the added challenge that if there's children involved, that the social system, all the social sector services are primed to support women and children in abusive situations. And really to look the other way, quite frankly, when it comes to fathers who come to them desperate for help. And I can't tell you how many men come to my agency, the Center for Men and Families, because everybody else has failed them. Police have failed them. Victim service agencies have failed them. They've gone to the hospitals because they're needing, you know, help for their injuries. And the hospitals, occasionally they'll even open up to nurses, and the nurses really don't care to hear it. So everybody else has been unavailable or unwilling to support them, and then in desperation they seek out our support. We've only been around for 3 years. I don't know where they've been going all this time. And then to compound that, the media is not all that interested in really telling these stories, so the public continues to believe these stories don't exist.
What are the statistics on domestic violence, you know, victims being men versus women? What are the statistics?
Well, so the statistics come from Statistics Canada. I think that's the best source. Mm-hmm. Statistics Canada does a portrait on family violence every 10 years, and every 10 years they come back with the same results, which is that domestic abuse is comparable in terms of the levels of abuse that are suffered by men and the levels suffered by women. Roughly 4% of men and 4% of women say that they've been victims of domestic abuse in the last 5 years. That's how the question is asked, which is also consistent with the best research that's being done by study family violence, and I can point you to our website where we've put up links to a number of meta studies. These are studies of studies, so
right.
studies
mm-hmm.
that look at like mm-hmm. the best scholarship that's been done in this area.
Right.
And again, they bear out this conclusion that women and men are equally likely to be abusers and to be abused.
At the extreme end of domestic violence, which is murder, it seems to me that although the murder rate of men in Canada is very similar to that of women, I think it is slightly lower, but murders in a domestic context are much higher for women, in terms of women being murdered by their domestic partners.
Yes, I think that's correct. The only caveat I would add is that women are more likely to get somebody else to end the life of their partner, and that other person is often another man. So the data will show up as a man murdering a man as opposed to a woman murdering a man. So I think that clouds the issue a little bit, but I'm not denying that in general it's true that at the most severe end of the homicides in particular, that women are at more risk than men are. So I think that's true, but I think at the same time, everybody needs more support. So women need more services, and I've never said we shouldn't do anything other than build more shelters and more services for women. But at the same time, I think having no shelters and supports for men, and some of these men have also been severely injured. They've had boiling water thrown at them. They've been stabbed with a knife.
Right.
Sometimes abuse has happened over many years. You know, I don't think we should look the other way with respect to what's happening to these men. So I would just like to see more support for everybody.
Right,
the issue
right.
with severity, though, one other important point is the most severe domestic abuse happens in the context of mutually abusive partners. And actually, most of the abuse itself is in mutually abusive situations where both men and women are abusive towards each other. That's the scenario where it's likely to escalate to very severe levels.
Right.
So, I mean, what I'm saying is if we acknowledge that men and women can both be aggressive, and if we intervene in both cases, more likely not only to be supporting men who might be in danger, but also women too.
Right.
We can't do wrong if we support victims in general. That's my kind of my view here.
Right.
For some reason, the paradigm isn't looking at that possibility that both men and women can be support.
So when do you expect this shelter to open, and how many spaces will it have?
Well, best case scenario would open in mid-2018, definitely within the next 12 months. It will depend to a large degree on the success of the fundraising campaign. So we do have a crowdfunding campaign up right now, gofundme.com/abusedmenshelter, if anybody wants more information.
And I presume that's linked from your cafe website?
Yes, you can go there too.
Yeah.
And we've also put up some stories of some of the men. So, you know, you're asking, for example, like, if men are bigger, why can't they defend themselves? One of the stories we posted is a man who is bigger
mm-hmm.
and looks bigger. And so people would often ask him, how could you not defend yourself, or why could you not sort of just get out of the situation? And he, I think, tells a very interesting answer to that. So,
well, can you describe that situation? Like, what?
Well, he was with his wife for about 6 or 7 years. He also has a son who's now a teenager, and his situation was one of escalation. So it started with verbal and sort of emotional abuse, manipulation, that sort
mm-hmm.
of thing. And as his partner realized that she could get more out of him by engaging in this way, it escalated further, eventually to physical abuse, and then it became physically abusive for a number of months. And he was the individual who was attacked with a pen. She used like a sharp pen and
right.
actually punctured him. So that's when he went to get help, and help was unavailable, and he contacted our agency. And not only has he become a client of ours, but he's also giving back by becoming a peer support facilitator. So he runs a support group for other men who are going through similar situations to what he went through. But his video's up there. We've got videos of men who had the police who were called to their homes, and they were arrested despite having bloody eyes or bloody faces and bruised eyes and all sorts of things. Some of these stories are pretty graphic
mm-hmm.
to warn people that, but we put them up there because I think it's really important to get home this message that even big, burly men can be victims in this way and really need the support, especially when it comes to these fathers. And most of the stories we tell are of fathers.
Right. I mean, it makes sense that just because somebody is big, that doesn't mean that they're violent, and just because somebody's attacked doesn't mean that their instinct is necessarily to attack back, because they might realize the consequences of that.
Right, exactly. And we haven't discussed violence in same-sex relationships, too. So that's another stigma. People don't want to hear anything other than the gender binary, which means that other scenarios also get left out. So you could have violence in lesbian relationships, which
right.
we don't talk very much about. Fine Leaders now services, thankfully, for lesbian women and gay men who are dealing with domestic abuse. The other one is elder abuse. We're becoming a little bit more aware of family abuse against elders.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
again, that doesn't fit the gender binary, you know, model. So that's also taken a long time to, you know, raise awareness about. So I actually see violence against men in the same kind of attitude, that if it's not fitting the stereotype, we don't want to talk about it.
And
I'm glad that we're
do you have clients
on many fronts.
Right. Do you have clients who are gay men?
Absolutely. Yeah, our organization, I should say, is very diverse. We have clients who are gay, who are bi, who are trans men, who are straight men. We also have a lot of women who are clients who volunteer. In fact, the volunteers, it's quite evenly mixed between men and women. That
mm-hmm.
surprises a lot of people, but it really shouldn't, because men and women, you know, love one another. They're friends with one another. We have a co-ed society, right? So if a man is suffering, it's going to impact that man's sister, that man's mother, that man's female friends, and consequently, women have really gravitated to our agency looking for support for men, looking to volunteer as therapists, as lawyers. We also do a legal program as social workers, and just in general to be involved in events or in other ways. It's been a very diverse kind of community.
Right. Well, I can imagine if a woman was the sister of a man and she felt that he was being abused, that she might want to provide him with support and probably see this thing differently than maybe she had in the past.
That happens all the time, yeah.
Yes, you have a conference coming up soon. When is your conference?
Well, we had one, actually.
Oh, sorry. I guess I missed it. I saw a notice at the conference. So tell me what happened at the conference. What was
yeah,
talked about?
Sure. So it's a conference we've been doing now for 3 years in a row called Healing Journeys, and it's very much related to this topic, because it's focused on men, trauma, and mental health. And what we do is we bring together survivors, male survivors of all forms of trauma and abuse. So yes, it's domestic abuse, but it's also men who have suffered childhood sex abuse. It's also men who have been dealing with PTSD and the mental health consequences of living
mm-hmm.
with abuse and trauma. And we also then bring to this conference the survivors, but then also the professionals, you know, the mental health workers, the therapists and social workers that work, nurses that work with these men. This particular year, I think, was a real kind of watershed moment because we had a really amazing mix of people who were coming to the conference from a cross-section of social service agencies in Toronto. So we had the police there. We had victim service agencies. We had hospitals who had sent nurses. We had a number of, actually, women's organizations, violence against women's organizations, who came out to the conference. Some of these organizations actually had us in recently to give workshops around male victims of domestic abuse. There's actually a lot of interest from social service agencies to kind of wake up and do a better job for men, because a lot of these agencies are starting to get more men contacting them, looking for help, and so they're trying to struggle to provide more assistance than they've been able to provide in the past. So I think that's marvelous that they're reaching out to us. So this conference brought all these actors together, and I thought that it was a very, very progressive moment for these agencies to hear directly from these men who had been through these experiences that we rarely hear about.
I mean, some women's organizations, like specifically the YWCA in Toronto and some other feminist and anti-domestic violence organizations, have been very critical of you, but you're saying some are now at least listening to you or working with you?
That's been true for the last 4 years. It just doesn't get reported in the papers.
Mm-hmm.
So the papers like to tell this battle of the sexes story. It doesn't
right.
matter if it's reality or not. And they will find somebody inevitably who can be made to say something critical about us. So then their job, they think, is done. But kind of behind the scenes, for the last 4 years, we've had women's organizations that have been working with us. This conference came came about as a result of a partnership with a major national women's organization, the Canadian Center for Abuse Awareness, which supports hundreds of frontline anti-abuse women's organizations and women's shelters. But the media, you know, never told that story. So we've been doing this conference for 3 years now. And for 3 years, we've been working with this major women's organization. This particular year, I'm noting that we had a wide variety of women's groups that were speaking at the event or guests at the event. So I thought that that's why it was a watershed moment. But it's been true for the last 3-4 years since we opened the center that we've been working collaboratively with many different women's groups. I mean, the Women's College Hospital, for example, has referred men to us. I note that because that happened just in the last few days, but we've got women's groups that, especially women's shelters, that we do a lot of collaborative work with. So if you think about it, I mentioned mutually violent situations, right? In that context, you're likely to have both a woman and a man who both need support. The women's groups can support the women, but they're not mandated to support the men, so they can refer the men to us, and we can do, you know, vice versa. So this really should be looked at as a collaborative opportunity and not as some kind of battle of the sexes, although the media just can't resist reporting it in that way.
Right, it's a very simple story. One side is good, the other side is bad. That makes a simple story. So are there situations where men end up at a women's shelter looking for help, you know, desperate to find somewhere and thinking maybe the women's shelter will be able to help them and they can't?
Yeah, it does happen quite frequently. And in fact, a couple of the family shelters in Toronto are really, at least the city tells us this, supposed to accept men in, provided that they can do so, you know, safely and securely. But we've tried referring men there, and every time they've been denied for one reason or another, which is one of the reasons we decided, well, we really need to open our own, because the city sort of thinks that they're already providing a service, but the men can't actually access it. So there's a bit of a disconnect. But having said that, what the women's shelters are increasingly doing to kind of make up for the fact that they don't want to have men in their facilities is they're at least giving them information to get them to our facility. Mm-hmm. We're not a shelter right now, but we can do other things. We can provide trauma counseling. We run a support group for male victims of abuse. We provide legal support in a family court situation because oftentimes that's connected. The one big thing we don't do is the shelter. So, of course, that's why we're fundraising to try to open the first family shelter for abused men in Toronto.
Yes. You've mentioned mental illness quite a bit, and it seems to me that in society, when there's mental illness, the upfront cheapest way to deal with it is to put somebody on a pill and send them on their way as opposed to talk therapy.
Yes.
So what's your approach to mental illness? Do you have one, or do you just send people to various psychologists or psychiatrists?
Well, we do a number of things in-house. We do have psychologists and social workers and psychotherapists. We don't have psychiatrists. We do have a relationship with the Father's Mental Health Program, which is run out of St. Joseph Hospital and Mount Sinai Hospital. These are two major hospitals in Toronto. Through that collaboration, we can refer clients to free psychiatric programs. There's a few conditions to it, but that's generally the way it works. But we do a variety of in-house and referral services that address a variety of men's mental health issues. And now, the debate about talk therapy versus medication, I mean, I'm not qualified to really weigh in on that, but I would say that we can provide both approaches depending on what the client's need is.
And generally, are these men suffering because of something that happened previously? Like, I know there's been many stories of soldiers who've gone to war, come back with PTSD, and then domestic violence happens. Or maybe it's not domestic violence, but they're drinking and their marriage breaks up or things like that. Like, is this mostly sort of men dealing with pre-existing conditions that worsen when they're in a stressful marital or common law situation?
Yeah, we do have clients whose mental health issues are more largely sort of biological, but I would say a majority of the men, they're dealing with something in the environment, whether it's abuse or trauma, not always domestic abuse, that could be another form of trauma, or it's the stress of a family breakup, it's the stress of a difficult resolve ongoing marriage problems. It could be they're having difficulties with their children, so we do get a lot of that, especially with respect to younger men. So we do have, last week, in fact, I had a dad that called the office. His son is struggling to stay in school, struggling to avoid sort of falling in with the wrong crowd, doesn't have the best role models in his life. So this dad's trying to do a better job for his son, maybe find like a mentor or some man that can serve as a support for his family, for him and his son. Just kind of plug into that community of healthy men trying to help each other, you know, resolve their issues in a healthy way. So that we do get that a lot, and I think supporting not only an individual but the whole family is something that we're hoping to do more of, because we note that a lot of the issues that face men can't really be resolved without also bringing into play the individuals in that person's life with whom he interacts, you know, on a regular basis.
Right. It seems to me that in many cases relationships get out of control because people don't know how to deal with the stresses that naturally occur in their relationships, and so things start to spiral as opposed to interactions helping to bring the relationship back to a good place. They end up taking it further away from that place. So do you have programs where men can try to deal with a better way to deal with stresses, or, you know, to deal with maybe their partner's outbursts or things like that, as opposed to you know, leaving, which is another, you know, quote, solution to the problem?
Yeah, I think a number of our programs do provide that. We have a number of mental health programs that are not topic specific, but they're more based around skill development.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that's individual or in group, or in the context, again, of a family breakup, we would be looking at providing men with skills they may not have, or they may want to become more adept at, around conflict resolution, around problem solving, around, you know, regulating their emotions so they can deal with things without, you know, getting frustrated or leaving the situation, so having sort of more control. I'd say that's a part of many of the different programs that we offer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I know you said you didn't have a lot of time. Is there anything else that you'd like to get out before we close up this discussion?
No, I think we've hit on a number of important themes. I would just sort of end again on that note that what we're doing is a collaborative project, and I refer back to that because I suspect some of your listeners, you know, might have read some things in the paper, and I would just ask them to take a look directly at what we're doing. And, you know, you want to read the news, that's perfectly fine, but just don't assume you're getting the whole story. I would just ask you to keep an open mind, go to our website, menandfamilies.org, menandfamilies.org.
I'll put the link in the show notes.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And, you know, we're very transparent, so everything we do is online. The videos of our events, the information on our programs, and then, of course, GoFundMe.com/AbusedMenShelter for the details specifically on the campaign we're running right now and where we share some of these men's stories. And then, you know, your listeners can judge for themselves whether these programs are important and whether they're making a difference. So, you know, we're very confident that we're doing some good in the community, and we want to continue to grow that.
Toronto is just one city. I mean, do you know of similar initiatives in other cities around the world?
Yes, so our center is in Toronto, but we're a national organization, and in fact, in September, we opened a sister office in Ottawa, so we now offer similar services,
mm-hmm.
Not everything just yet, but in time we will, in Ottawa, and we do have branches in Vancouver, in Calgary, in Montreal, in a number of other places, where eventually we hope to be opening centers. So
mm-hmm.
not yet, but we're looking at community partners in some of these places I've just named in order to grow the social services that we can provide in collaboration in these other communities.
Right, and what about in the United States? Are there organizations like yours there at all?
We are, by design, quite focused on Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I'm really an authority to...
Okay, you haven't heard of any...
Beyond the country.
Right, you haven't heard of any organizations that do similar things outside?
That do the services? No. I know we did research when we put a proposal together for our own shelter. So, yes, there are a number of smaller men's shelters in the States. Actually, for some reason, in some of the smaller communities, you'd expect them to be in the big cities, but
yes.
They're not. You know, New York, Los Angeles, not a single men's shelter for abused men, but in some smaller places, I think in Arkansas and Texas, the names of the agencies, I don't have at my fingertips.
Right, no, that's
fine.
But
I can send that to you. You can put that online.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there are a few services for abused men that are starting to pop up in the United States.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me today. It has been an interesting discussion, and like you say, it's generally seems to me to be treated in the press with a very stereotypical and simplistic approach to the subject.
Yes, I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks again.
Okay, goodbye. Justin sure didn't sound like the stereotype of a men's rights activist to me, i.e. someone who's angry and defensive and blames all their own problems on women. I could tell, however, that he was very careful with his words as he stepped through the minefield of domestic and sexual abuse from the perspective of male victims. Just because one group is affected by a problem more than another, it doesn't mean that the problem in other groups can be ignored. Overcriminalization in the United States is, for example, clearly a bigger problem with black men than other groups, but that doesn't mean it's not a problem for black women or for white men. I think everyone could accept that, but in the context of domestic abuse, we act as if it wasn't a problem for men at all, except as victims of other men. But just because women are less likely to sexually abuse men, it doesn't mean that they can't be verbally abusive or violent. But now let's turn to that thorny issue of sexual harassment. Why do I think sexual harassment is so important, and why do I think I have something worth adding to the debate? Well, it, first of all, is important, but I don't think it can be separated from concerns about justice and due process. There will be false accusations, and it isn't okay to just assume that because the majority of accusations are true, that falsely accused men can be sacrificed for the greater good. I think of Wilbert Jones, just released after almost 46 years in jail in Louisiana after being falsely convicted of rape. True, this was police or prosecutorial misconduct, but other cases have been due to false accusations. My interview with Chenaya Kelly on July the 11th of this year talked about her father in jail for almost 20 years, who was sentenced on the basis of her words when she was 8 years old, which she says were coerced out of her by her mother and the prosecutor. I also think we need to put the accusations in context. Some of the Me Too hashtag have been relatively trivial and just devalue the experience of the smaller number of women who have experienced long-term harassment, violent rape, or other really serious crimes. Other activities are not even illegal. Dan Barton's penis pic was sent to one of his lovers. If there was a crime, it was the person who made it public. Embarrassing, perhaps hypocritical, but not illegal. And Roy Moore wanting to date 19-year-olds when he was in his 30s is not a crime, perhaps against his espoused moral values and creepy, but not a crime. Sexually assaulting them when he managed to get them alone, that was a crime. Monica Lewinsky was not a crime until Bill Clinton lied about it because it was consensual sex. It was immoral because Bill was married, unbecoming of the office of president, certainly. But there were other cases in which Bill Clinton is accused of coercive sex or outright rape. That's not to say we have to use legal standards when deciding when to vote for someone or deciding whether to watch someone acting or listen to them on the radio. If you find it unsettling that a Senate candidate would have a history of dating teenagers, that alone, even if all of them had been willing and of the age of consent, may be enough for you to change your mind. If you would never vote for Bill Clinton or Donald Trump because they were unfaithful to your wives and not for the crimes they may have committed, that's your choice. But let's separate the illegal from the immoral, the slimy, or the merely embarrassing. For many of these men, we can ignore the stuff that's not illegal because there's more than enough illegal activity. Perhaps the best new example of a horrible overreaction is the downfall of Garrison Keillor, who's long been one of America's most loved radio personalities with his Prairie Home Companion and other shows, and which show his dry and delicate sense of humor. The treatment of him shocks me. This is what he said, quoted in an article in The Hill, a political journal. I put my hand on a woman's bare back. I meant to pat her back after she told me about her unhappiness, and her shirt was open, and my hand went up about 6 inches. She recoiled. I sent her an email of apology later, and she replied that she had forgiven me and not to think about it. We were friends. We continued to be friendly until her lawyer called. But despite this, he didn't lose his sense of humor. If I had a dollar for every woman who asked to take a selfie with me and who slipped an arm around me and let it drift down below the belt line, I'd have at least $100. So this is a poetic irony of a high order. And also, getting fired is a real distinction in broadcasting, and I've waited 50 years for the honor. All of my heroes got fired. I only wish it could have been for something more heroic. On this basis, Minnesota Public Radio stopped rebroadcasts of the Prairie Home Companion and the Writer's Almanac. Perhaps Keeler is being dishonest. Perhaps more women will come forwards and detail situations that can't be explained as a slip of the hand, pun intended. But unless Minnesota Public Radio has more evidence at present, then their actions are cowardly and shameful. If they do, maybe I'll have to eat crow later. But we cannot simply believe the victims because we don't know someone's a victim until the evidence is examined. A more accurate hashtag would be to believe the accuser, but clearly that wouldn't work because it would make a mockery of justice. Other accusations definitely have more weight. Weinstein essentially admitted to sexual assault on a wire, and his accusations against him are remarkably consistent. Bill Clinton had multiple accusers, and I'm not talking about Monica Lewinsky. Ditto for Donald Trump, both so far unpunished. Bill Cosby has admitted to drugging women for the purposes of raping them. The behavior of John Conyers and Charlie Rose and others is particularly bizarre and shocking for men so widely admired. And now let's add Matt Lauer. I must admit that I cannot comprehend the actions of Weinstein, Conyers, Rose, and Louis C.K., in particular, who paraded totally or partly naked in front of their victims, or, in the case of Weinstein and Louis C.K., masturbated in front of them. I'm not sure this is really sexual. In fact, I think it's really about power and the desire to humiliate. Supporting this is the fact that some accusations also included non-sexual verbal abuse. A crime like masturbating in front of a woman is obviously less serious than forcing oneself upon her and raping her, or in some cases upon a man. But they are harder for me to understand. Perhaps it's the difference between going into a house to steal stuff and going into a house simply to smash stuff up and steal nothing. I just don't get it. Why didn't women or men, in the case of somebody like Kevin Spacey, complain before now? Surely nobody thinks this kind of behavior is acceptable. As an aside, I remember once I was at a hotel for business meetings. I went for a run in the morning and returned sweaty and puffing to my room with only enough time for a quick shower, only to find that my key didn't work and I couldn't get in. I called down and they said they'd send somebody up to help me. As luck would have it, it's the only time I've had a hotel room right next door to the meeting room. I remember trying to fade into the wall as I waited for the security guard to come upstairs, as all my colleagues walked past me as I stood there in my short shorts and t-shirt covered in sweat. It was probably only 10 minutes, but it seemed like forever. After that, I had the occasional nightmare about showing up at a business meeting in my house coat or even totally naked. I just didn't know it was possible, I suppose. So why don't more women complain? Well, I previously talked about the Italian model who accused Weinstein of sexual assault, went to the NYPD, wore a wire, and got Weinstein to admit sexual assault on tape. And then the prosecutor decided not to press charges, which many people think was due to the power of Weinstein. That's the word power again. I've also mentioned the two New York Police Department officers accused of raping a woman in handcuffs. Laughably, they say that the sex was consensual. Sadder still, it's apparently not a crime for a New York police officer to have sex on the job. I can't imagine it was easy for her to file charges, but it was made even worse when she was at the hospital for the rape kit procedure, according to the New York Post, and 9 policemen showed up to try to convince her not to press charges against their 2 fellow officers. The article describes how one officer was browbeating them in the native Russian of the woman and her mother, who was also present, and kept his hand over his badge so they couldn't see his name or number. Just for the record, DNA from the woman matched the two NYPD officers she had accused, Richard Hall and Eddie Martins. And then there's the U.S. congressional process for reporting inappropriate behavior by a politician, sexual, abusive, or otherwise. It takes 180 days and requires you to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Payments are from public funds, or in most cases from the politician's own slush fund to keep the payment further from the public eye. Not only is this an unfair process, but it keeps the behavior secret. It forces the woman to stay, or perhaps a man, to stay with her abuser for a long time. It also means that the next idealistic intern or secretary, so excited to be working for a famous and honored man, doesn't realize what she or he's walking into. Some people have tried to make it about politics. Republicans who say it's all Democrats and Democrats who say it's all Republicans. But is the behavior of Bill Clinton worse than Donald Trump or vice versa? For every Democrat John Conyers, we have a Republican like Brent Farenthold. I know that's not exactly a household name. Farenthold paid off a woman, Lauren Green, his former communications director, for a total of $84,000 of your dollars, at least if you're an American. Perhaps the only politician to allow the special congressional fund to pay it rather than out of his own funds. It's not exactly clear what he did, but the sum of $84,000 tells you that it must have been pretty significant. And it's not just show business, politics, and policemen. Former U.S. women's gymnastics team and Michigan State University doctor Larry Nassar is going to plead guilty to multiple charges of sexual assault against the young female gymnasts in his care. A total of 195 women have complained. He will be sentenced to at least 25 years. And he's not alone. Many other gymnastics coaches and other staff have been suspected or accused of similar behavior. Again, we have older men wielding a different kind of power. That's that word again. The power to make or break a gymnastics career, taking advantage of their access to an endless pool of girls and women and their desire to please the coaches to achieve their Olympic dreams. It's hard to see rehabilitation for some of these men, Weinstein, Cosby, Nassar, among others. I can't cry if their legacies are destroyed by their abuse. But what about men guilty of lesser crimes who appear to be making a sincere effort to make amends, like Louis C.K., the comedian, who admitted what he had done, although I'm incredulous that he ever thought it was okay. His stage persona was a messed up man, and that seems pretty true to his real personality. Can he be saved? Will the women he abused, because his behavior was abused, be willing to forgive him if he really is trying to reform? Similarly with Al Franken, additionally with him, there is a suspicion that some right-wing operatives have encouraged the exaggeration or invention of some charges. If the treatment of every man is the same, a scorched earth policy making them unemployable and destroying their legacy, if they had one, it will only encourage abusers to be more careful and, when accused, to go nuclear against their accusers. I also worry that we are damaging the ability of men and women to talk about sex seriously or jokingly. In the United Kingdom, the Daily Mail reports that Strictly Come Dancing star Gemma Atkinson is sharing naughty messages with older married former contestant Simon Rimmer. He's 54, she's 33. She's doing this on a WhatsApp group set up for the contestants, so this is semi-public and everyone involved seems to think it's fun. But what if it was the other way around, an older man sending naughty messages to a younger woman? Would it be funny then? And if not, why not? For each of these cases, I think we need to step back and evaluate the severity of the accusations, the confirmatory evidence, if there is any, and the actions of the person accused. This isn't a one-size-fits-all situation. Some of these men deserve what they are getting, whether it's everlasting shame or being literally defaced. We use the word deface just to mean a deliberate spoiling of something, such as graffiti on a white wall. But the Romans, after assassinating one of their emperors, which they did on a regular basis, they would literally chisel the face of the old emperor off all of the statues, sometimes chiseling the new emperor's face instead or just leaving it blank. A literal defacing, an erasing of history. Sometimes that's warranted, not always. I think some of these men can be rehabilitated. Others don't appear to have done anything wrong. Let's not move from a justified desire to ensure that people with little power, men or women, have the ability to work without harassment, even when working for rich, powerful, and famous men. Let's not move to a new prudishness and McCarthyism. Let's think before jumping to conclusions. If the conclusion is to jump, so be it. But let's always think first. I posted this statement on my personal Facebook page. My fragile male ego is hoping that not every man given power over other people would turn into abuser. It would be nice to hear of very rich and powerful people who, despite all that, are still decent human beings and don't treat people beneath them as, well, beneath them. But it's not looking terribly good for this hope right now. I'm going to get some interesting comments. Dennis on my Facebook page wrote, we had an incident in the United States some 300 years ago called the Salem Witch Hunt, wherein a host of young women swore that they'd been sexually assaulted by witches, leading to the execution of a number of innocent people. Melanie wrote, I work for people of wealth, and all of them have been wonderful to me over 16 years. Donald said about the same thing. I worked in business for three Standard & Poor's 500 companies. This type of activity did not happen. Jesus wrote, there are about 3 billion men on the planet, and a few hundred million of them are in positions of power. It may seem like the reports of several hundred of them being creepers makes all men look bad, but try to keep it in perspective. Melissa said, it's not so bad. Damaged people regardless of wealth or status, a friend once said. We just have to stop the cycle. Mel said, agreed. With some of these men, it's broken me. I've respected them as actors, politicians, journalists. It makes me wonder if there are any good ones out there. Time for some good stories about inspiring people in positions of power who build people up. Thank you for listening to episode 165 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. And don't forget to write me if you'd like one of the books I'm offering, and don't forget to include your mailing address. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.